is on Buddhist images of fierceness. So I think it's not just Buddhism, probably, that we often think of spiritual practice as being something that is supposed to make us loving and kind and full of equanimity, sweetness and light. And then, in Buddhism, anger/ill will is one of the three poisons that is at the root of all suffering. We have a precept against not indulging anger. But I have heard quite a few reports recently, given what's going on in our world right now, not that any of it's really new, a lot of anger. And I think there is a tendency to, wonder how to work with it, figure in a sense that it needs to be let go of, transcended, something like that, so that we can, be calm and good and loving and send metta to even to our enemies and all of that, which I talked about a few weeks ago. But I wanted to explore today the place of fierceness and even anger in Buddhism. And primarily, I will do this through imagery. So this tends to be part of our iconography, which means if you're not that familiar with Buddhism, even though the roots of it are very, very straightforward, right? Like the Buddha's original teachings, the Pali Canon, it's all very down to earth and rational. You meditate, you explore your own mind, etc. But even early on, Buddhism was forming in a cultural and religious context, which was very rich, full of deities and spirits and demons and heaven realms and hell realms and all this kind of stuff. So it's not that original Buddhism was dependent on these things, but it evolved with that context. So people had a rich cultural imagery for things. And that only with the evolution of Buddhism then, with the Mahayana and later, those kinds of deities and spirits and dharma protectors and stuff were incorporated in a more formal way into Buddhism itself. So even in the Pali Canon, you'll hear talk about demons and deities and serpent kings and things like that, because they just assume, like, of course those things exist. And then later on, Mahayana incorporates things and then even includes them in Buddhist scriptures and sutras. So in terms of how to relate to these images of bodhisattvas or dharma protectors or deities and things like that, whatever your response is fine. If you don't really like this kind of imagery, if you think, like, that's not the Buddhism I'm interested in, that's fine. But you may really, really appreciate this stuff. Sometimes people, this is a really big part of their practice, is relating to archetypal bodhisattvas and even even praying to archetypal bodhisattvas and things. So I guess, take what is useful. I personally find that a lot of it's like the Joseph Campbell talks about myth and how myth is not about something necessarily that's true, but it has truth in it. It conveys an important truth for human culture. So in a way, you could look at these, rebirth and deities and these kinds of things as they are trying to convey some truth. it doesn't necessarily matter that they are literally true in any way. So, because this is so focused on imagery, I am going to show you some slides. So I am going to share my screen with you and walk you through kind of short PowerPoint. So I'm just going to give you something to look at while I am talking. So, is anybody having trouble seeing Kuan Yin, the Bodhisattva of Compassion? Oh no, Ruth Ann, you won't be able to see this. I'll try to describe what's going
right.
on.
But I appreciate you naming, because Kuan Yin, I have a little statue of her. I'm aware of her. Thank you.
Yeah, so I will describe as we go anyway. So, if anybody else, go ahead and chat or message Bob or something like that if you're having any trouble. And I apologize if you're just watching this on a phone or something, you can't see much, but... So this is an image of Kuan Yin or Kanzeon. So she is the embodiment of compassion, the archetype of compassion, and is a kind of a later evolution from Avalokiteshvara, who was the, you know, the original name and manifestation. It had a male aspect, but particularly in China, kind of understandably, the Bodhisattva of Compassion took on feminine aspects and a feminine form, even though most Bodhisattvas are quite androgynous looking. Don't even really have a gender. So this is, I think, I chose this image of Kanzeon, and this, the posture that she's in is called royal ease. So, you know, she's not even stiffly sitting up in meditation. She's at ease. She's ready to get up and assist. And she has a little child in her lap. So it's a very, very warm and compassionate image. So this, I feel like this is a great image that goes along with our ideal of equanimity and acceptance and love for all beings. So this next image, and if you have... There's a little box that shows a few people's Zoom images, and if that's in the way of any of these images, you can usually move it around on your screen and get it out of the way. So this is Avalokiteshvara, and particularly Avalokiteshvara even is shown in many different ways, but this is the thousand-armed version, the thousand arms and 11 heads. So I told this story about Avalokiteshvara a couple weeks ago, or maybe it was last week, I don't know, where Avalokiteshvara took a vow to save every last living being. He looked out with his supernatural powers and he saw just all of the suffering in the world, and he made this vow that he would never stop trying to save living beings, and that if he did, if he had any doubts, if he wanted to quit, that then his head would break into 100 pieces. And then he worked tirelessly for a long, long, long time, and then he used his supernatural powers, and he looked out. He had saved countless beings. And then he looked out over the universe again, and he saw the number of sentient beings had not decreased at all. And he felt such despair that he thought, I need to give up and just save myself. And then his head broke into 100 pieces because of his vow. Then the Buddha Amitabha put him back together. And as he did, Avalokiteshvara asked, you know, as long as you're putting my body back together, can you give me 1,000 arms with which to respond to need, and 1,000 eyes? So in the palm of each one of those hands, which this statue looks like it actually has 1,000 hands. I don't know if it literally does. It's very beautiful. There is a eye in the palm of each hand. And then also 11 heads in order to be able to just, you know, see in all directions. Now, most of the heads, 10 of the heads, there's a Buddha head at the top, And 10 of the heads are, you know, this kind of calm, full of equanimity, bodhisattva image. But one of them, you'll see toward the very top, looks different. And here's a close-up of that. So the Amitabha gave Avalokiteshvara one wrathful face. So this is a wrathful, angry-looking, teeth-bared face. For those beings for whom that is necessary, that you need to present in that way in order to save them from delusion and suffering. So I wanted to go back, not forward. There we go. Here's the option. So there's a lot of images of warriors and swords, because a lot of times even Manjushri carries a sword. I don't know if you've seen that. I thought I had that in my slideshow here, but I guess not. The Manjushri image, the Bodhisattva of Wisdom, is often riding on a beast, a lion-like beast. And the one in our Zendo doesn't have a sword, but Manjushri typically does. So this is, you know, for cutting through delusion. So there's these kind of violent, wrathful images that pop up in Buddhism. So what kind of warrior is this? So this is a beautiful quote from the Discourse on the Great Lam Rim by the 13th Dalai Lama. Said the Bodhisattva is like the mightiest of warriors, but her enemies are not common foes of flesh and bone. His fight is with the inner delusions, the afflictions of self-cherishing and ego-grasping, those most terrible of demons that catch living beings in the snares of confusion and cause them forever to wander in pain, frustration, and sorrow. Her mission is to harm ignorance and delusion, never living beings. These he looks upon with kindness, patience, and empathy, cherishing them like a mother cherishes her only child. She is the real hero, calmly facing any hardship in order to bring peace, happiness, and liberation to the world. So I will return to that in a bit, but I wanted to share with you that it's pretty, it's traditional in the Soto Zen school, and it may go back further than Soto Zen, but I know in Soto Zen there's a tradition of presenting a triptych, a three-part, either three separate altars, or like this piece is three panels that show Shakyamuni Buddha in the middle, and then a bodhisattva called Samantabhadra on the left or one side, and Manjushri on the other. And this is a explanation from the Japanese Sotoshu website about Fugen, if Fugen is the name of the, another name for Samantabhadra. So Samantabhadra, when it came to Japan, came called Fugen. So Fugen means widely, Fu, virtuous, worthy, or able. Again, a bodhisattva who is often paired with Manju or Manjushri Bodhisattva, as one of the two attendant figures who flank in the image of Shakyamuni Buddha. In this arrangement, Fugen is said to represent the Buddha's compassion, whereas Manju represents the Buddha's wisdom. Those being the two complementary virtues that all bodhisattvas should cultivate. When paired with Manju, let's see what I got next here. So these are, they often come in paired statues. So this is without Shakyamuni Buddha, with Manjushri on the left this time, sitting on the beast, which we often say is like the beast of self, and Samantabhadra sitting on an elephant. When paired with Manju, Fugen is the active party, practicing morality and meditation, fulfilling vows to save all living beings, and appearing in all Buddha lands. Manju, or Manjushri, in contrast, passively surveys the emptiness of all dharmas and cuts off all attachments to them. Fugen, riding a white elephant with six tusks, attends the Buddha on his right side. Manju, riding a lion, attends the Buddha on his left side. So I think this is a beautiful iconographic portrayal of these two aspects of practice that need to be present in all of us and balanced, where there's kind of the coolness and detachment of wisdom and emptiness and the absolute, and then Samantabhadra is the engagement of vows and saving living beings and bodhisattva vow. And this, you know, in many cases, the image of Avalokiteshvara kind of is what we use in place of Samantabhadra. So they both have to do with love and compassion and bodhisattva response. But there's a little bit of a difference in terms of the overall spirit, which is conveyed in Taigen Dan Leighton's book, Faces of Compassion, where he talks about the different archetypal bodhisattvas. And one of the things he does in there is suggest modern examples of these different archetypal bodhisattvas. And Kanzeon or Kuan Yin or Avalokiteshvara is that, which I've talked about recently, is this witnessing, is this listening, is this compassionate presence. And there's a kind of natural response that arises out of compassion, but it's very immediate. Whereas Samantabhadra is a little more, you say, proactive. You might take a vow to do something or to save living beings, and then you go out and you get to work. So Leighton suggests, for example, a classic modern example of Avalokiteshvara might be Mother Teresa, who is out, you know, witnessing, being present with suffering and responding to it in a very immediate way. And Samantabhadra might be, or Fugen might be best exemplified by someone like Martin Luther King, who had more of a engaged effort to change things. So one thing that is very interesting is that, so even this Samantabhadra, I mean, sometimes the elephant can look a little more lively, and Samantabhadra is active, but looks still pretty mellow, pretty full of equanimity. Now there's Fugen, just left it out of order here. So this is a kind of a Japanese version of Samantabhadra. So this is a picture of Sojiji Monastery. We trace our lineage back through Sojiji, which is in Japan. It's one of the two main monasteries of Soto Zen Buddhism. And Sojiji, this not actually at this location, but the original Sojiji Monastery was somewhere else. And that temple had been a Shingon temple before it became a Soto Zen temple. Now, Shingon is the Japanese, what do we want to say? Vajrayana, kind of tantric Buddhism, form of Buddhism. So just like in China and Tibet, the kind of Vajrayana Buddhism that we associate with the Dalai Lama and Tibet, that's their version of of Vajrayana Buddhism. There's other forms of that kind of Buddhism, and when it came to Japan, it's called Shingon. So it's Buddhist, but it's a very different flavor of Buddhism. However, it was very common in Japan and elsewhere in Asia for, you know, temples to be, you know, there, things changed in the area and this temple becomes, you know, was a Shinto shrine. Now it's a Buddhist monastery. Now it's a Shinto shrine. So they went through different phases, but there was usually a fair amount of respect given to whatever came before. So the story is that Sojiji was originally a Shingon temple and had a shrine to another figure named Fudo. So this is Fudo Myo-o, who is he arose early on, even before Vajrayana arose in China, and he's a Dharma protector. He's also seen kind of as a deity amongst a set of deities, but in any case, he has this very fierce aspect. So there he is with a sword and a angry expression and sharp teeth, like a big fang. One fang's going up, one fang's going down. In his other hand, he has a rope, and then he's always surrounded by flames. So it's a very, very fierce, very masculine, very strong looking image. And in this case, he's seated, but oftentimes, like in this next image, he's standing. So I'm not exactly sure how they do this in Sojiji, but what I heard at Dharma Rain was this was why we actually had Manjushri as our central image in the Zendo. We had Kanzan over on one side as kind of the compassionate, and then we had Fudo on the altar on the other side. So in some senses, you could look at Fudo as being, he replaced Fugen or Samantabhadra in our lineage's imagery. So that kind of active, centered by vow, set out to save all beings, but still kind of removed, still kind of full of equanimity, that bodhisattva was replaced by this even more fierce image. So if you think about what it is, and I've been meaning to get a Fudo image in our Zendo, which, you know, some people might misunderstand when they first see it. But it does occur to me that there's a place in our practice and is our in our practice space for what I might call a more masculine energy. And I don't mean to say that as in men have a handle on this and women don't or something, but that we all have these aspects within ourselves. And I think when we're facing the kind of situation we are in the world right now, it can be useful to find a place in our hearts and in our practice for this kind of energy, to summon this kind of fierceness and determination, the clarity of a warrior. I mean, if Fudo is going to bind and then destroy delusion, I mean, that takes some discriminating mind. That takes some, like, this is delusion. I am going to destroy it. So I will come back to this stuff. But I wanted to put you in breakouts and ask you the question. What is your response to this fierce imagery? And how do we stay focused, as the line from the Dalai Lama said, how do we stay focused on harming ignorance and delusion, but not living beings? So how can we summon that kind of fierce, determined, clear energy but keep it somehow focused on ignorance and delusion, not living beings. And it, and if you want to, you can go beyond that question or divert from that question if you want. So I will invite you all. Back. All right. Welcome back. So we had a interesting discussion. We were left with a little conundrum to ponder, which was pointing out that this imagery of bodhisattvas with swords, fierce bodhisattvas with swords, you know, seems kind of poetic to us now, with like, you know, you don't, swords aren't your, you know, general weapon of choice. But what would this look like if Fudo was standing there with a gun? And I was like, huh, I don't like that image. That, I don't know, somehow, if the sword is, if the sword is metaphorical, I don't know, a sword's a different metaphor than a gun, I guess. I guess you can shoot delusions, but it doesn't work quite as well. But it does, I don't know what you talked about in your groups, and I totally understand if this kind of imagery doesn't do anything for you, or even is aversive. But how about I do have something that I want to close with, but I will open it up. Looks like Jinryu has raised her hand.
Well, we didn't get a chance to discuss this question in our group because we ran out of time. But I'm interested in, I wish I could find the words that you said earlier before we went into the workout group about how I think a lot of this is internal. In fact, Manjushri has always been my hero because he tamed the beast within. So how do I internalize, or do I, Fudo?
That's a good question. I want to open it up, and you know, if anybody else has thoughts on that, please chime in. I forgot to mention that Fudo's name, the translation of his name, is Immovable One. So there's an aspect of solidity and immovability, even in the face of great challenge.
I like that. I've been thinking about Aikido a lot because we talked about that one evening a while back, and that's what it reminds me of.
And I was in my group, I also said, and Shintai, you can say something about this if you want. I was told a story, which I think actually is apocryphal. I have not found any reference to it except I heard it at Dharma Rain. But the interpretation of this statue, so usually it's, you know, it's Fudo standing on a rock, and he has a sword, and he has a rope, and he's surrounded by flames. And so what I was told was that he's standing on a rock in hell, and he has made a vow to stay in hell until all beings there are liberated. Sounds like a little bit of a kludge between him and Jizo, but I like the story. Shintai, do you have...
Yes, I remember that story, and I remember it being told as being chained to a rock in hell. not to, not standing, but chained to a rock in hell until circumstances transformed. So,
so I'm not the only one. So it got even more exciting than that. Yeah. So I think that's a good question. It's like how like Junior's question is, how do we how would we apply this internally?
How do you do it for Kanzian? Why would it be different?
Well, Kanzian is all accepting, gentle love, and
so our delusion,
you know, is immovable.
I don't want to be accepting of delusions. I don't think, for me anyway, that's not what my practice is about. And if I need a sword to slice through them, I'll take the sword. And I do it from a place, as best as I can, from a centered place of acceptance that still has the compassion of Kanzian. But I'm not going to stand there and get stomped on. I need also that fire to say, hey, this is a sacred circle that's around me. I'm respecting this sacred circle. The Native Americans on their prayer circle, the Lakotas, at least the prayers that I've learned, in the center is a fire. And that's where the inner child is and the innocence. No one is allowed to cross from one side of the rim of the circle across that fire to the other side. It's very much honored and respected. Anyway, I'm talking too much today. I'm fired up with compassionate anger. It's really, I like Fudo.
Shouldn't I?
I'll just share that, sitting at Dharma Rain in the space, there would be, you know, the main altar, and there'd be Fudo on one side and Kanzian on the other, and I would sit on the side of the altar.
Oop, you're muted.
Drat. I'm nattering on to myself here. At Dharma Rain, I remember sitting in the hall and choosing which side to sit on, depending on which energy I felt like I really needed to cultivate. So sitting on the Fudo side of the hall, when I felt like I needed perseverance and willingness to face what I needed to face. Like sometimes there was so much like internal emotional pain that I just needed, and it felt like sitting in hell, chained to a rock, and saying, I will sit with this. I will sit with this until something shifts, until I have some something. I will sit with this. And then sitting on the Kanzian side of the hall when I was kind of leaning more into honestly, self-compassion and acceptance. But I really loved having both of those places and kind of sitting in the hall according to what I was wanting to cultivate in myself.
Thank you.
Here's an idea. Am I being heard?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I wasn't sure. It's going mute and then not mute. Perhaps a way of using anger and fierceness is to bolster our ability to refrain, to use restraint and refrain from responding too much or too quickly. And it's not using something against ourselves, it is using something that is an energy that we don't necessarily, energy doesn't have to be unleashed or tapped. You know, it can be something that you just hold, right?
I like that.
Does that make sense? I'm making sense?
Yeah. Somebody else. Yeah, I mean, I don't know if if this is kind of what you were relating to, but I know for me, I feel like that energy, I'm being asked, or it's being suggested to me by this imagery and by these teachings, to tap into a kind of well, energy, determination, clarity, motivation that I wouldn't necessarily otherwise, like somebody in our I think Belinda or Phyllis talked about hearing about an image of when you're sitting in zazen, that you might sit as if you were a general on a horse and at the head of an army. And I like that kind of, you know, as opposed to like, I'm just sitting. There's a whole different energy when we have a sense of kind of responsibility, and that we're facing something, and that we're...
May I say anything else, or should I wait? Because I've said way too much.
Well, maybe we can see if other people jump in who haven't spoken yet.
Use that energy, fierceness, and anger to take a look at yourself.
Yeah. I mean, we have to be so, that balance, right, between the compassion and the firmness is so important. So like all of these things are like medicine. They're appropriate for one situation and not for another, like Shintai was saying about. And I think in our practice, this is part of what we learn, is to monitor ourselves and learn what works and what is needed now. And there's certainly, we can use inner violence and have it be completely counterproductive. even subtle judgment and violence, it can just be very unhelpful. So to that extent, like, I know one of the images that I have really hated is the idea of cutting off thoughts. So sometimes you'll get that instruction in zazen, just like, thoughts are crap, they're useless, they go on all the time, they mean nothing, cut them off. And I just, that for me, like, that is disruptive, right? Because there's a little part of me that's like, yeah, let's cut off all those thoughts. And that's not the part that should be in charge during zazen. Really, like, not helpful. So we have to be very, very careful. Like, you know, when is it time to apply this kind of energy? So Adine, you raised his hand there. No, you're still muted.
Yeah, in my group, I was talking about the fact, as some of you know, I used to be a high school teacher in San Francisco, in a very urban school. And a lot of times the compassion was fierce, because the nature of society is such that whether I wanted it or not, I had the sort of duty as the one to break up fights in the hall. And invariably was between someone who was stronger and someone who was weaker. And in all of those cases, the kids, I loved them all. However, I was not going to allow them to put each other's eye out or put, you know, someone in the hospital as well. So, I mean, I think, so for me, the idea of compassionate fierceness is, I just sort of go back to that life experience.
Thanks. And there's that aspect, like Avalokiteshvara has all these faces and has one wrathful face out of 11. So it's not like, you know, half the time you'll be wrathful, but one wrathful face out of 11 for those beings that are not in it. And I can think of examples in my life where I was, especially as a woman, I was too soft and unclear. I was too like, well, I don't really like that. Would you? and I should have, because we're afraid of unleashing anger, right? I mean, it's scary and we tend to do damage, and it's a risky energy. But sometimes, I mean, there's times that I look back on that I wish I had just, you know, not worried about making a mistake and let that out as a way to protect myself or someone else. And I think that, because there's some ways that it's only when we're speaking like that, I mean, to tie it all back to what's going on right now, right? I mean, we all want peaceful protests, but there's anger out there. And if that is not, and when we see it, when we hear it, when we see it expressed, I mean, it's, I mean, then the question is, then what do we do? But there's a time and a place for that to be expressed so that we realize what's going on.
Yeah. I like Fudo, and I don't know if I'm muted or not.
Yeah, no, we hear you.
Oh. Well, you mentioned medicine. Indigenous peoples have more than one medicine in their little tote. And Confucius said to know when to pivot is divine. So as you said, movable Fudo. And the trouble for me with a gun is once the bullet leaves, there's no control. But the imagery of a sword, you still have your hand on the sword. And you can cut through negative. And I'm glad you said that about toss out ideas, because that's what we need to do when we're sitting. But today I asked myself, why am I having these thoughts? And I needed a good bit of the good side of pride for a moment.
Thank you.
Well, brought us to 12:15. Thank you all for...
Oh, no. I mean, if you have to pop off, do so. But I forgot. I have one more slide for you, and I really want to share it because it's very, very
interesting. Bring it.
So... All right, so this is big. Oop. Well, maybe you can just see it like that. So I'm going to read this, because this is from a beautiful, I think it's from like the 12th century, or it's 12 centuries old, I forget. But this is a Tibetan legend, which some of you might have heard of, called the Legend of the Shambhala Warriors. And this is as told by Joanna Macy. She describes her teacher telling her this story. And it says, "There comes a time when all life on earth is in danger. Barbarian powers have arisen. Although they waste their wealth in preparations to annihilate each other, they have much in common. Weapons of unfathomable devastation and technologies that lay waste the world. It is now, when the future of all beings hangs by the frailest of threads, that the kingdom of Shambhala emerges. Now comes the time when great courage is required of that Shambhala warrior, moral and physical courage, for they must go into the very heart of the barbarian power and dismantle the weapons. To remove these weapons, in every sense of the word, they must go into the corridors of power where decisions are made. The Shambhala warriors know they can do this because the weapons are manomaya, mind made. This is very important. Why the human mind? The Shambhala warriors know that the dangers that threaten life on earth do not come from evil deities or extraterrestrial powers. They arise from our own choices and relationships." So I can give you that reference if you want. I find that I need to read that every week or so, when I start to feel discouraged about my, about many things, but particularly about my climate activism. And just repeating that, like, we can change this because the problems that we are facing are created by humans. They are created by us. Therefore, we can unmake them. So, just to give you a little more determination. So thank you all for coming. And
this is being recorded, but can we get access to your slide presentation?
Probably. I'm not sure exactly how to do that, but at very least I'll insert the pictures into the same page that you can link to the audio.
Great. Thank you.
All right. Take care, everyone. Have a good day.
Thank you.
Thanks,
thank you.
Everyone.
Thank you.
Thank
you. Bye. Bye, everybody.